Welcome to the Dublin Festival of History podcast, brought to you by Dublin City Council. In this episode from the Dublin Festival of History 2023, Fergus Whelan remembers the revolutionary and poet Dr. William Drennan, 1754 to 1820. Dr. Drennan, a one-time elder of the Dublin Unitarian Church congregation, was born the son of a Unitarian minister and made his life's work the building of a brotherhood of affection to break down the brazen walls of separation which had been erected between Irishmen by distinctions of rank, property and religious persuasion. Fergus Whelan is the author of May Tyrants Tremble. This episode was recorded at the Dublin Unitarian Church on the 28th of September 2023.
Thank you and thank you very much all for coming here today. The slide in front of you there is a picture of First Presbyterian Church, Rosemary Street, as it is today. William Drennan was born here in 1754. He was born in the manse, which is the manse is the house in which the minister lives. He was born there because his father was actually minister of Rosemary Street. Before his father was in Rosemary Street, we'll see in a while, he was in Dublin. And he worked for the forerunners of this congregation in two capacities. One, he was a school teacher, and two, he was a minister. When I started off to write this biography of William Drennan, I was quite surprised that nobody else had tried it before me, because the sources available to me were very, very rich, both from Drennan himself and his sister, Martha McTeer. They corresponded, they were both excellent writers, and they corresponded from 1778 until 1819, over 1,400 letters, which have all been published in three volumes by the Irish Manuscripts Commission. Now, usually a biographer of somebody of this period, the early modern period, has to go through handwritten letters and find out who's who and try cross-reference. All that work was done for me by the Management Commission. So it made the task a lot easier than it might have been. Now, in order to put something in context here, I'm going to have to jump ahead before I come back to the beginning. The United Irishmen, both in Belfast and Dublin, as an organisation, was established in 1791. Just 1 year afterwards, the situation had become quite tense and quite dangerous in December of 1792. The United Irish Organisation tried to revive the Irish Volunteers. The Irish Volunteers had arisen at the time of the American Revolution, when Ireland was denuded of British troops. They were all off in an unsuccessful attempt to put down George Washington. The Protestants of Ireland set up a volunteer corps all over Ireland, and they paid for their own uniforms, they paid for their own weapons and so on. And eventually, though, they started to put a bit of pressure on the British government to bring in certain reforms that they were seeking. The most important one was they were looking for free trade. And at the time, the British government were were in difficulty in America. They were losing the war in America. And the volunteers had some success in forcing the government's hands in relation to free trade. In late 1792, the United Irishmen are trying to revive the volunteers. And in December of that year, just when the King of France is put on trial, the United Irishmen announce that they're setting up a new corps of volunteers in Dublin, called the National Guard. Now, that was pretty provocative to the government, because the National Guard was the National Guard of France had been the people who had just arrested the King of France. So they decided the British government were having none of it, and they said that if the volunteer, any corps of volunteers assembled anywhere in Dublin, they would be dispersed by force. William Drennan was outraged by this, and he decided that the government had to be defied. So we wrote a pamphlet with the words there, citizen soldiers to arms. Now again, talk about provocative, citizen soldiers to arms, when the government had just banned volunteering. That pamphlet would see Drennan stand in trial for seditious libel. And when he stood trial, the prosecution were trying to paint him as in league with the French, disloyal to, and by the way, everybody knew it, even by the time of the trial, France and Britain were at war. And the prosecution were trying to paint Drennan as some sort of French Jacobin who was on the side of the enemy, etc. He was very anxious to get across the idea that his politics, his liberal democratic politics, had nothing to do with France and everything to do with Ireland. So this is what he said. I am the son of an honest man, a minister of that gospel which breeds peace and goodwill amongst men, a Protestant dissenting minister in the town of Belfast. My father was a friend and an associate of good, and may I say, of great men, of Abernethy, Bruce, Ducal, and Hutchinson. He doesn't even think he's... This is addressed to a jury of established church Protestants in Dublin in the mid-1790s. He doesn't even have to give these men the first name. He assumes that these people are so well known that he doesn't even have to give them any more information. So who were these well-known people? Well, here's three of them. I couldn't get images of Bruce or Ducal. This is Thomas Drennan, William Drennan's father. This is John Abernethy, and this is Francis Hutchinson. The first two, Abernethy and Drennan, were ministers of religion. They were Presbyterian ministers, and they both, at one time or another, worked for the ancestor of this congregation, the Wood Street congregation, in the 1720s. And the most significant figure here is Hutchinson. Hutchinson eventually wins a huge international reputation. And in fact, he's described by Benjamin Franklin as the ingenious Mr. Hutchinson. He was born in St. Field in County Down in 1690, the second son of a Presbyterian minister. He goes to Glasgow University to study for the Presbyterian ministry, but on graduation, he's invited here to Dublin by the Protestant dissenters of Dublin to set up an academy. And he brings William Drennan's father, who was his great friend from his college days, he brings him to Dublin with him, and they both work in this academy, which, by the way, was in a place called Drumcondra Lane, which today we would know as the corner of Dominic Street, Bolton Street and Dorset Street. So who were they teaching in Drumcondra Lane? Well, the grandparents of the Dublin Protestant dissenters would have come here with Oliver Cromwell, or in the wake of Oliver Cromwell's army, after the Cromwell invasion of Ireland, if you like. There were several congregations and gathered, but Rory has already told you the two important ones. Wood Street, which moved to Great Strand Street in 1763, and New Row, which moved to Eustace Street in 1729. This is the only image extant that I know of the Great Strand Street congregation. If you want to know what the Eustace Street one looked like, that's easy because it's still there. It's the Ark. It's the Children's Art Centre in Eustace Street. Now, both of those congregations are the ancestor of this congregation, and it was the cradle of the. Those congregations were the cradle of the initial leadership of the Dublin United Irishmen. The same can be said of Rosemary Street that we saw on the first slide. Many of the leaders of the Belfast United Irishmen were affiliated to the congregation in Rosemary Street. And as we know already, both Drennan and his father were associated with both the Dublin Unitarian congregations and the Belfast ones. When Hutchinson was teaching at the academy, he wasn't just teaching. He was writing very significant work of philosophy called an inquiry into our original ideas of beauty and virtue. And it's, to try to put it as simply as I can, it's a refutation of the philosophy of Thomas Hobbes and Mandeville, who were at the time, they were very much in the ascendancy, and their line was that man is basically evil, that man is always going to look after his self-interest as opposed to anybody else. And that it's, for instance, Hobbes's idea was, unless you had strong central authority, political authority to keep people in line, unless you had strong religious authority to keep people in fear of eternal damnation, then everybody would run amok and you'd have anarchy and you'd have, as he said, war of all against all. Hutchinson totally rejected that idea, and basically his simple philosophy was, given a choice, even with children, given a choice between, they can tell very quickly what's nasty and greedy and what's benevolent and what's kind and so on, and that children gravitate towards kindness rather than the opposite. Now, that might seem sort of pretty naive, but also might seem pretty sort of, not that remarkable, but it is remarkable. Because in those days, they say, for instance, the Protestant church were regarded, the only people who were capable of benevolence and kindness and all the rest of it were people who had learned the Christian religion or were part of the Christian religion. Hutchinson was saying, even heathens, every heathen who never heard of Christianity or whatever else is capable of kindness and proper ethical behaviour and so on. This is Robert Molesworth. Robert Molesworth was born in Dublin in Fishamble Street in 1656. His father had come to Dublin with Oliver Cromwell's army, and he's said to have made a fortune supplying that army, and he also ended up getting an awful lot of property and an awful lot of land in Ireland as a result of that. He actually died a couple of days before Robert Molesworth was born. So he almost is born into huge wealth and so on. I could talk about him for a long time, but I'm just going to skip on just to say this. The main part he has for us here tonight is that he was the patron of the people we've already met, Hutchinson, Ducal, Abernethy, and Bruce. And by the way, Bruce maybe, I should mention, he wasn't a clergyman. Bruce was an elder of one of these congregations, all right, but he was basically a radical book publisher, and he was a cousin of Francis Hutchinson, and he was the person who first published Hutchinson's great work that we saw earlier on. Now, this is Caroline Robbins, who was working in Harvard University. She's a British historian working in Harvard University in the 1950s. And she said that this group in Dublin, in the 1720s and 30s, she said they were the spiritual heirs and ancestors of revolutionaries everywhere. So how could they be both the heirs of and the ancestors? Well, what she meant was they were the heirs of the Cromwellian Revolution and the Glorious Revolution, and they were the ancestors of the American Revolution, and to some extent, I would argue, also of the 1798 rebellion. The Wood Street, the congregations we've mentioned up to now were all New Light Presbyterian congregations. William Drennan, always in his private correspondence, described himself as a Unitarian. In his public statements, he described himself as a Protestant dissenter. One thing that's clear from studying his life is that he wore his religion very, very lightly indeed. Even though his father, he was very, very anti-clerical. He was very much against priests, either Protestant or Catholic, and even Unitarian ministers who tried to lord it over their flocks and tell their flocks what was true and whatever. And his view was that they were always very, very open. Priests and ministers, even Unitarian ministers, were open to corruption. That governments would use things like the Regnum Donum was a thing where the government would pay clergymen. Drennan said this was a poison being poured into the Protestant dissentient community. So he was very, very anti the clergy of all sorts. When Tom Paine wrote his famous Age of Reason, which was a huge attack on Christianity and so-called revealed religion and so on, Martha, his sister, who was always looking for opportunities to push her brother to become famous through writing, She said that she thought that she agreed with a lot of what Tom Paine had said about the Old Testament, but she said he was weak on the New Testament, and that a good answer, if Dresden could come up with a good answer to Thomas Paine's Age of Reason, that he could become famous and well-known and he'd gain a lot of credit and so on. But Dresden wouldn't do it. He said, first of all, he wasn't that interested in the question, and also he was quite clearly in sympathy with what Paine was saying. But this is what the New Light Presbyterians, this is what their formal position is. Just in case you can't read it, I'll read it out to you. They claim that they are created by a love of freedom. They have ever championed a cause that gave them birth. Whether the freedom was that of the coloured slave, the honest religious inquirer, they have fearlessly taken on the side of justice and resisted every attempt to stifle private judgment. An ardent desire to bring about the brotherhood of man has led them to generously support many charitable and benevolent institutions of a non-sectarian nature. After the volunteers had gone into decline, the reform movement in Ireland, morale was very, very low. People didn't know what they reckoned the Parliament was never going to reform itself. They were never going to make them things any more democratic. They were actually going to, in the opposite direction, and they were never going to give any formal relief to Roman Catholics in terms of the penal laws. That all changed when the Bastille fell on the 14th of July, 1789. And all of the, and Wolfe Tone tells us, for instance, that the reform, everybody suddenly said there is an opportunity now to make advances. So Drennan was very quickly in May of 1791. He wrote to his brother-in-law, Sam McTeer. Drennan by this stage is in Dublin. He writes to Sam McTeer and he tells him, I'm going to start a club. He said, a benevolent conspiracy, a plot of the people, a brotherhood's name, the rights of man and the greatest happiness of the greatest number, its general aim, real independence to Ireland, republicanism, its particular purpose. Now that statement that the greatest happiness for the greatest number is straight out of the Francis Hutcheson philosophy that we met earlier. So here he is. He's basically the first person to suggest that a society of united Irishmen should be found. And he's saying a conspiracy. He's not necessarily saying it's secret, but he's saying it's definitely a conspiracy. It's going to be, they're going to be public to some extent, but they're not going to be public about everything. Even before the formal meetings, the formal starts of the club, he starts to write ideas and propaganda and so on for the organisation that he knows is about to be launched. And he lamented what he described as the brazen walls of separation that had been erected amongst the inhabitants of Ireland by distinction of rank, property and religious persuasion. He composed a test, a solemn oath that each member of the new society was going to take. And it committed them to forwarding a brotherhood of affection, a communion of rights, a union of power amongst Irishmen of every religious persuasion. This picture, the image, is very, very common in Belfast. And it's a picture of the volunteers a couple of weeks before the Society of United Irishmen is formally formed in Belfast. It's the volunteers marching through High Street in Belfast. If the image was better, you'd see the flags are the flags of the French Republic, the French flag and the American flag. And Drennan had written to his brother-in-law, Sam McTeer. And I'm not sure whether what was in the letter was advice or whether it was instructions. But he told Sam McTeer what was to happen that day in Belfast, what banners were to be carried, what resolutions were to be passed, what sort of flags were to be carried, and so on. And you read that letter, and then if you read the Belfast newspapers the week afterwards, you see all of those things to the very detail. It appears that this particular event was planned by Drennan, even though he's not even in Belfast at the time it takes place. These Belfast men, when they would have their big parades, they loved to parade in uniform with their weapons and their uniforms and all the rest of it. And they also liked to party afterwards. And normally the party would take, they would adjourn to the Donegal Arms and make a hell of a lot of toasts. If they were taking a sip for every toast they made, they were probably pretty well on by the end of the night. And here's an example of the toast that day. The toasting in the Donegal Arms after the parade to the 14th of July, 1789. That's to the fall of the Bastille. Lasting freedom and prosperity to the United States of America. The Republic of the United States of America is only a decade old at this time. The Rights of Man. Tom Paine, just weeks before, or months before anyway, had published his Rights of Man. And Wolf Tone tells us that the Rights of Man by this stage is the, what he's called the Quran of Belfast, the Quran of Belfast. The Union of Irishmen. So they're toasting the Society of the United Irishmen, and it hasn't even been formed yet, but they know it's going to be formed. This is important. The Society for the Abolition of the Slave Trade. One of the things that the United Irishmen and William Drennan was one of his lifelong issues was the abolition of slavery and total opposition to any form of slavery. To Tom Paine, may perverted eloquence ever find so able an opposer. So what does that mean? Just shortly before Edmund Burke, Dublin-born Edmund Burke, had published his famous Reflections on the Revolution in France, which was a vicious attack on this man here, Dr. Price. It was a Protestant descent minister, born in Wales, but in living in London, who had welcomed the French Revolution. So Burke not only attacked the very idea of the French Revolution, he attacked all the people in England who thought that the French Revolution was a good idea. The second person to answer him was Tom Paine. The first person actually to answer him was Mary Wollstonecraft. But they were toasting Tom Paine for ably opposing the perverted eloquence of Edmund Burke. The memory of John Locke, the memory of Dr. Franklin, and the memory of Dr. Price, who had just passed away a short while before these proceedings. Just a word about this man here, Archibald Hamilton Rowan. He was a member of the Great Strand Street congregation. He was the first chairman of the United Irishmen. In 1794, he's imprisoned for that, for distributing the pamphlet, that Drennan's pamphlet, Citizen Soldiers to Arms. When he's in prison, he gets a visit from William Jackson, who is an agent from the French Revolutionary Government, and he engages it with him in a sort of unwise way. The British cop onto it. They have enough. He's in prison at this time. They have enough to hang him. So he had a couple of things going for him. One of the things he had going for him was he was a very wealthy man. So he was able to bribe his jailers, and he was able to escape from prison. But he also managed to escape from the country, which was not easy. He got three Hout fishermen to evade the British fleet and get to France. So an important member of linked to this congregation. Now, after he fled to France, that was the opportunity the government had been waiting for, and they closed down the United Irish Society, they seized its funds, they banned it, and this is the first time that the United Irish Society becomes a secret organisation. The other thing they do is, 2 years after the event, they put Drennan on trial for seditious libel. He's been in Green Street all day, hearing the charges and the evidence against him, and he's convinced he's going to be convicted. And he writes on his knee, he says, he writes a letter to his sister who's in Belfast. My heart does not tremble, although my hand does. His hand was trembling because he didn't have anything to lean on. So he was saying, even though he was convinced he was going to jail, he wasn't worried. Most historians don't accept that for a minute. The Orthodox history tells us that after he, after his brush with the law, he withdrew from the United Irishmen, and some of them even say he developed a distaste for extreme politics and stood aloof from the radicals. None of this is true. This is all nonsense. He did, however, avoid direct involvement in the underground armed conspiracy. But what he became was basically the literary propagandist for the United Irishmen, and played that role right up until the rebellion, and even to some extent after the rebellion. Shortly after his acquittal, he met with Wolfe Tone and Wolfe Tone's great friend Thomas Russell, the Cork man. Tone had been mixed up and had been entrapped in the Jackson affair, and when Archibald Hamilton Rowan had escaped from the country, Tone basically was... The government knew that Tone was involved, but they couldn't prove it. So a deal was done that he and his family could get out of the country and he was never to come back. And they didn't charge him. That wasn't benevolence on their part. It was just that they didn't think they could make the charges stick. He went to America, but then he went to France. And the Duke of Wellington commented many years afterwards on Wolfe Tone's period in France. As he came to France with 100 guineas in his pocket, and he came very close to changing the destiny of Europe. Now, that's some praise from somebody who's essentially his main enemy. Moving on then, but in 1797, the United Irishmen are now a secret, outbound, armed conspiracy, and they're getting ready for revolution. And the French had come, Wolfe Tone had succeeded in bringing the French to Banshee Bay in 1796, and they didn't land. We all know that story. They went back. But the government thought they were coming back, and so did everybody else think they were coming back. So the government policy then was to provoke a rebellion before the French returned so that they could take on the Irish, who would be armed only with pikes and so on, and they could crush the rebellion before they had any help from the French. So one of the amongst the many atrocities was they judicially murdered William Orr in Carrickfergus in 1797. He was convicted of administering an oath to various militiamen or whatever. He was convicted by a drunken jury. The jury were drunk at the time, and the jury were also told that they wouldn't be let out of the jury room till they brought back the right verdict. So he was basically judicially murdered, and this outraged William Drennan. It outraged everybody, but William Drennan decided to do what he did best. Drennan had a long history of one of his systems of getting his ideas out there was he would pick a particular figure. It might be Edmund Burke, it might be Lord Fitzwilliam, it might be Charles J. Fox, and he'd write them a long letter, but it's an open letter, and he'd get it published in the papers. By this stage, the only paper that would publish anything by the United Irishmen was the Press, which was the United Irishman's own paper. It was a semi-underground paper, and it was getting closer and closer to being banned. But he wrote to the Press under the pseudonym Marcus. If he'd used his own name, it would have been suicidal. Under the pseudonym Marcus, he excoriated Camden, the Lord Lieutenant, telling him his regime had brought only massacre, rape, desolation and terror to the people of Ireland. And that the letter gets even stronger after that. He didn't hold back at all. The authorities didn't know who'd written this letter, but they wanted to know. So they arrested the printer, a fellow called Stockdale, and they basically threatened Stockdale that they would castrate him if he didn't give the name of the person who wrote but he didn't. And he never disclosed, and so they never were aware that Drennan had written that letter. One informer described Drennan as having a very dangerous pen, and I think Drennan would have regarded that as praise indeed. The Wake of William Morris is probably his most famous poem. It was published in the press just before the press was suppressed by the military. Of course, he didn't sign it. It would have been suicidal to sign that at that time. So it appears anonymously in the press. 20 years afterwards, when it's safe to do so, he claims that poem, you know, but he wasn't prepared to claim it when it was too dangerous to do so. And the last line of it, the last verse of it is, this is in early 1798, and this is what he's saying, the Wake of William Morris, conquer fortune, persevere, lo it breaks the morning clear, the cheerful cock awakes the skies, the day has come, arise, arise. Now, historians were telling us that he'd given up on all this stuff. And here he is in 1798 writing poetry in the press, basically calling for a rebellion. He also wrote a song called Erin. Unfortunately, he did say that he got some clergyman to put the an air to it, but I haven't been able to find any air for it. But I just want to read some of the words of it because I think they're interesting. Alas, poor Erin, some are still seen, who would dye the grass red from their hatred to green. Yet, oh, when you're up and they're down, let them live. Then yield them the mercy that they would not give. Arm of Erin, be strong, but be gentle as brave. An uplift to strike, but be still ready to save. Let no feeling of vengeance presume or defile the cause of the men or of the Emerald Isle. That's the first time the term Emerald Oil was ever used to describe Ireland. Some cynics say he has a lot to answer for, but luckily I'm not a cynic. This is a cartoon, probably easier to see. This is a cartoon that was actually done by William Drennan himself. And it's pictures, a firing squad shooting four blindfolded prisoners. And it refers to the executions of four members of the Monaghan Militia on the 16th of May, 1797. Now, Drennan, to some extent, had been misinformed about this. These guys were arrested in Belfast. They were tried in Belfast. They were marched from Belfast under huge military guard out to Blairismuir Camp, where they put kneeling on their coffins, and they were shot. Drennan had been told that a Scots regiment had refused to shoot them, and that an Irish regiment had indeed shot them. This was never published. This was when soldiers, when the military took over the offices of the press, stole the machine and so on. I think this is where this document fell into government hands, and it never was published. It's in the rebellion papers in the archive, the National Archive. So the chances are, this was now... from government sources, if you like. But this is what the poem says. When bid to take aim at the Irishman's heart, the stout Caledonian recoiled with a start. The first of my country, the first of my clan, ere ordered to fire on a blindfolded man. So spoke the indignant and high-minded Scot, as a soldier he'd serve, as a hangman would not. But the Irish went first and the Irish went last, and the guarded by the Irish, the prisoners passed. On their coffins knelt down, took a silent farewell. The anointed fired and the anointed fell. Now, he was misinformed about that. He thought that an Irish regiment had actually shot their own people. In fact, it was British soldiers who carried out the executions on Blairismuir. We know, or I know, almost nothing of what Drennan was doing in Dublin in 1798. Much to his own surprise, he was not picked up. The government did know something. They didn't know about the Marcus letter, but they did know, thanks to an informer called Sham Square, they did know that Drennan was involved with the press. Everybody else who was involved with the press was either arrested or got William Sampson, the editor, for instance, got out of the country ahead of them. But Drennan himself was quite surprised that he was never arrested. So we don't really know. And he stopped writing to his sister during the rebellion. So we don't know. He tells us that martial law was declared on the 18th of May. That was just basically the rebellion was supposed to start on the 23rd of May. He tells us Dublin is filled with troops and spoils on every street corner and so on. Other than that, we don't really know what's going on. We do know that his close friends, Francis Bacon, Reverend Boyle Moody, Oliver Bond, Bagnall Harvey, Edward Fitzgerald and Wolfe Tone all die in the course, if not the rebellion, in the course of that year. We know his other friends, Rowan, Emmett, Nielsen, Tandy, Tennant, Arthur O'Connor, William Sampson, are either in prison or in exile. We don't know if Drennan saw the dozens of rebels hanging from Carlisle Bridge or the hundreds of murdered corpses and murdered rebels that were jumped into a pit beside the Royal Barracks, which is where Collins Barracks is today. From the time he came to Dublin, Drennan was very, very intimately involved with the Emmett family. One of the first times he went to dinner in Dublin, he became a great friend. He was a guest of and became a great friend of Robert Emmett Sr., Robert Emmett's father. He also was a friend of Thomas Addis Emmett. On that first dinner in Dublin in 1790, a young 12-year-old boy came out and recited for them after dinner one of the papers that Drennan had written during his volunteering days. That young boy grew up to be Robert Emmett. Thomas Addis Emmett and Mary Ann Emmett were members of this congregation. We still have the baptismal register where the Emmett children were baptised. At the back of the hall there, before you leave, if you've time, you should take a look at the marriage certificate of Robert Holmes, who married Mary Ann Emmett, both declaring to be Protestant dissenters. And Robert Emmett's signature is on that. His father's signature is on it. John Patton, his brother-in-law, who was also a member of the United Irishmen, signature is on it. And the presiding minister is a fellow called Moody. And I mentioned another Moody earlier. His younger brother was minister in Uri, and he was actually killed in the course of the rebellion. The Emmett family were destroyed by both the 1798 rebellion and Robert's rebellion of 5 years later in 1803. Thomas Addis Emmett had to get out to America. Robert Emmett Sr. died very shortly before the rebellion, and leaving a lot of money to Robert, which he was able to use in pursuing his rebellion. Robert Emmett himself is arrested when his mum is sick. She's so sick that they don't even tell her that he's been arrested. She dies a couple of days before he is actually executed, and he only finds out, Leonard McNally, his lawyer, tells him that the night before he's executed, that his mother has died. His sister, Mary Ann Emmett, is her Holmes, who's on the marriage certificate. He's locked up after Emmett's rebellion for a short while, and his wife is looking after a child, and she's also pregnant, but she's also dying of TB. That child was baptised here and is on the register downstairs, and shortly afterwards, his mother, Mary Ann Emmett, died too. And this is what Drennan said in one letter to his sister. Maybe better to read it here. "The Emmetts, I think, are a striking instance of suffering. Mrs. Holmes," that's Mary Ann Emmett, "will not survive long. I saw her today and her health is failing. Yet she is not sensible to her situation. Her deafness at all times is great, but much increased. And she has few female friends she can bear. It's a long winter for the Emmett family." Coming to the end now, but just I want to make this point, because this is one of the most moving things I found in the correspondence. Martha McTeer, his sister-in-law, was desperately fond of Thomas Russell. Thomas Russell was caught up in Emmett's rebellion. He was arrested in Dublin, and he was brought. He spent a little while up around County Down and up around Belfast on the run. He's brought to Carrickfergus, where he was executed. And it caused Martha great distress to think of Russell on the run, lying in hovels and ditches, and not approaching a habitation or involving any friend in his troubles. And this is what she says. Few have a known like him. Heart and enthusiasm is laughed to scorn now and fares the same fate as patriotism. Yet the two former, we may presume, will have a place in heaven, though so dangerous here. So, just in relation to this book, My Tyrants Tremble, I would suggest there are a few new things in it. First of all, there was a consensus, very, very strong consensus amongst historians that Drennan was basically very anti-Catholic. He was not. He was very anti sometimes the Catholic Committee, the tactics of the Catholic Committee, who we thought were playing two sides of the... They were on one hand aligning to the government and the other hand aligning to the United Irishmen. He said they're two strings to their bow, but then he said, but it's good and it's fair archery. He also resented the fact that he lost a lot of his customers, his patients. He was a doctor because of his stance in favour of the Catholics. He worked in Dublin for 10 years and he never had a Catholic patient. No Catholic. The Catholics would send their sick or whatever to Catholic doctors. But he was not in any way, he was a champion of Catholic rights almost from the beginning, not quite from the beginning, but certainly from the time of the United Irishmen till his death more than 20 years later. Until now, it was believed that he withdrew from the radical politics after Soylent 1794. I think I've made a good case here that doesn't stand up. He was writing literary propaganda right up to the rebellion. And in fact, I believe there's some evidence that he was writing propaganda even after the rebellion. He remained a radical all his life. His politics, the last letter he ever wrote was about the Peterloo massacre, that famous thing, that there was a film about it there recently where the workers in Manchester were attacked by the cavalry for demanding democracy. His greatest achievement has to be that he set up the first university that was set up in Ireland after Trinity College, that was set up in 1590 or something. He said in 1810 or so, I can't really remember the date, he sets up the Belfast Academical Institute, which was a university. It only ceased to be a university when Queen's opened 50 years later and the third level staff moved over to Queen's. But I have to say, he failed in the main objective of his life, which was he never did manage to break down the brazen walls of separation. The union of Irishmen, which Drennan advocated, evaporated as Orange Unionism and Catholic Nationalism went their separate ways in mutual animosity. 200 years have passed since William Drennan's death. In all that time, Drennan's hometown of Belfast has known sectarian hatred and intercommunal tension, often exploding into murder and mayhem. The brazen walls of separation are no longer just an elegant metaphor honed by William Drennan. No, they are the ugly physical construct which, with no sense of irony, is called a peace wall. These brazen walls of separation have been erected at the request of residents on both sides to keep Belfast's most deprived citizens apart. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Dublin Festival of History. The festival is brought to you by Dublin City Council and organised by Dublin City Libraries, in partnership with Dublin City Council Culture Company. For further podcast episodes and for all the latest festival news, be sure to visit dublinfestivalofhistory.ie or follow us on Instagram.